dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most important facets of the increasingly dangerous war we find ourselves in, be it perhaps undeclared or simply unrecognized, but we're in this phase of an ongoing multi-generational struggle with enemies of freedom, is the one that is taking place on the seas of the world. And it's important to remember that some 70% of the world's surface is covered by water. And those who have appreciated the importance of controlling, or at least being able to protect your interests on those waters, have generally, in centuries past and today, tended to come out rather better than those who don't. A man who has understood these matters closely and spent most of his professional life engaged in actually executing strategy and policies and programs to assure that it is the United States Navy that is the dominant power on the world's oceans is our guest for this full hour. He's a longtime friend and very much admired colleague. His name is Seth Cropsey. He has served in a number of important capacities, including as the Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, and as an assistant to the Secretary of Defense, with whom I had the privilege of working as well, Caspar Weinberger, during the Reagan administration. Before all that, he was a naval officer from 1985 to 2004. And these days, he is doing extremely important work as the director of the Center for American Sea Power at the highly regarded Hudson Institute. He writes prolifically on these subjects, including several important books. One of my favorites is Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy. Mr. Secretary, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us. Thank you, and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year and all that to you. But thank you for taking an hour to talk with us about these important topics.
Thank you, Frank, and for the nice introduction.
Well, I think it's well deserved, don't you? Let me talk to you about China, Seth. I'm interested in getting sort of, if I could say, the lay of the land. I think that's not quite right. The lay of the seas, perhaps, on various fronts. But one that is particularly ominous, it seems to me, is what Communist China is doing. And you called attention recently, I believe, to a photograph that's been making the rounds of just one of the naval shipyards that China is operating. Tell us about what that photograph showed and what it's really representative of that is troubling indeed.
I think things have changed a lot in the naval balance between the United States and China over the past 20 to 25 years. One way of looking at this, although it's, and I think that, by the way, I think that all the ways of looking at it have their flaws. So, and we can talk about that. But one way of looking at it is fleet size. And the Chinese are doing better and better. We can go into that. And another way is what two countries' naval shipyards turn out. And in the first 2 years of this century, that is 2000 and 2001, or right, I should say 2001 and 2002, our naval shipyards output was about 225,000 tons. That, at that time, that was 10 times the size of China's. If you look in our own Defense Department's most recent annual report on Chinese military power, you'll see that Chinese naval shipyards output from 2015 to 17 was about 375,000 tons, and that is a little bit more than twice ours. So that's just one measure, and I admit immediately that it's an imperfect one, but it shows a trend. And the real issue here is not today, although there are such people as Admiral Phil Davidson, who is the commander of the Indo-Pacific, U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, who told the Senate committee before his confirmation to hold that position, that if there were a war, naval war with China today, that he couldn't predict the outcome. But it's just it's one of many, many signs that that your show is very timely, and the subject is very important.
And Seth, let me just ask you, because it's one thing to talk about, you know, tons. What about quality of ships? What about the character of the ships that the Chinese are now, you know, churning out? It seems like sausages at the moment.
It's sausages. Are not such a bad thing in this business if you're trying to complicate the enemy's problem and disperse your your ships and give a foe more things to think about, especially if you're able to make the ships capable. They don't have to be capable of doing everything, but if they're capable of doing one or two things well, they have to be taken seriously. I go back to this story, or I think about this story when you ask your question about in the late Reagan administration, when relations between the United States and China were much warmer than they are, or more friendly than they are today. An Assistant Secretary of the Navy was invited to visit China and was given sort of the red carpet treatment and asked a lot of questions and allowed to see naval bases and so on and so forth. And he came back and reported that the commanding officer of the Chinese submarine forces had asked him this question: do you, Mr. American Naval Assistant Secretary, put your crews into the hospital for a 30-day observation after they return from a deployment aboard a nuclear submarine? And, of course, that got a good chuckle from the people who heard it, because we didn't do anything of the sort. Our boats and we'll be in the future quite safe. But the Chinese have come a long, long way since then. They don't do that anymore.
The implication being that they were obliged because of safety problems with their nuclear reactor shielding and that sort of thing. We're going to come back and discuss what the Chinese Navy is actually doing to threaten ours with Seth Cropsey, the former Deputy Undersecretary of the United States Navy and author of Mayday, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Seth Cropsey, a man who has practiced strategic naval power as well as written prolifically about it and warned, among other things, in his important book, Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy, about the implications of ours waning and others rising. We're speaking about specifically what's happening with communist China at the moment. And Seth, I asked you a question about what kinds of armaments are the Chinese bringing to bear, whether they're on ships or, for that matter, ashore, and perhaps in the air and in space, for that matter, as well.
In space, we know because of the tests that the Chinese performed 4 years ago that they were able to destroy one of their own satellites that had outlived its usefulness. So that's clearly a capability that they possess and one whose value they understand because of our extensive reliance on space for communications and surveillance. So those, that's a problem for us. So on the missile side, they are armed to the teeth with missiles and, you know, intermediate range, longer range, shorter range, hypersonics, the DF-21, which has the advertised but yet unproven capability to hit a large platform ship, that means an aircraft carrier, that is underway at sea at a distance of about 1,000 miles. So the combination of those is a major, major contributor to their effort to deny access and deny the area within 500 to 1,000 miles and beyond to American naval ships, both in, if there's a conflict. And that means that our effectiveness in whatever we choose to do within that area is at risk, as are our communications with allies like Japan, for example, and our and the bases that we have from Guam to Japan. So that's a serious matter. And if you had, reinforcing the point that was made earlier, if you had told an American admiral 20 or fewer years ago, as little as 15 years ago, that the Chinese would possess the capability, the realistic possibility of hitting an American aircraft carrier 1,000 miles from their shores while it was underway, the admiral probably would have been amused and might have laughed. And I don't hear any laughter on that score anymore.
It is no joking matter. Seth, talk a little bit about the geostrategic implications. You've talked about the Chinese being able to keep American naval vessels at bay, the repercussions that that could have for our alliances with nations like Japan and South Korea, presumably, among others, Taiwan. This is not an accident, is it? This is something that is part of a seemingly quite comprehensive design by the Chinese, including, of course, these military assets and great improvements to them in quantity as well as quality, but also in terms of what they're doing to sort of seize the ground and create the assets from which to project power through various choke points all over the world, including, of course, the South China Sea. What is the grand design that the Chinese are pursuing, of which, you know, their naval buildup is one manifestation?
First, hegemony in Asia, and second, supplanting the United States as the world's preeminent military power, and third, creating in place of the liberal international order that the United States policy has aimed at for over a century, replacing that with an order with Chinese characteristics, which means mercantilism, and if we don't like you, then we're going to crush you.
So global dominance is their agenda. And you've written, in addition to May Day, of course, another extraordinarily insightful book describing our response to this kind of growing danger. You called it Sea Blindness, How America is Surrendering Its Command of the Seas. And it's bad enough that we're dealing with this kind of threat from China and its growth, more and more overt and unmistakable. But let's talk about Russia. What is the Russian Navy up to now, both in terms of its own modernization program and its use of those assets all over the world?
Well, the Russian Navy is considerably less of a threat than the Chinese one, but Putin has been pretty open about his objectives. I mean, he called the end of the Soviet Union, what was his famous phrase, the greatest geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. Putin would like to, I mean, his objectives are several. Instability in the price of energy and oil worldwide, because Russia benefits from that instability as the price of energy goes up, and that's their major source of income. He's interested in reestablishing Russia as a great power, not necessarily a competitor to the United States, but one that's respected and that that is able to achieve the other major objective of his, which is to break up NATO without a fight. Yes, that means improvements in modernization of his military. They've been working on submarines, which is an old tradition dating from before World War II, to have a large fleet of submarines. They've been patrolling in the North Atlantic, and they've been working very hard on hypersonic missiles, against which we and nobody else have any defenses at this point. And they've been improving their relationship with China, developing their Pacific fleet. It's not on the verge of becoming as much of a threat as the Chinese fleet, but if they get together and their relationship can last, can survive the fact of two authoritarian governments, which is difficult, that's a problem for us.
It is. And to the extent that those vessels are, in fact, now increasingly being equipped also with quite advanced weaponry. You mentioned hypersonic missiles are coming into the Chinese fleet. They evidently are going to be widely dispersed through the new Russian ships that are coming online. And it's my understanding, Seth, maybe you can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but that we have scarcely any, if indeed any, defense against such missiles, either at sea or ashore. Even if the Chinese are a more advanced or comprehensive threat than the Russian Navy, it's a problem.
No, it's a problem. It's a problem for them, too, because they don't have any defenses against hypersonics either, and we're working on it. We're a little bit behind the times, but I'm confident that with resources and time and energy that we'll do just fine. I'm not worried about that.
It's just a question of, you know, the enemy gets a vote, as they say. Let me ask you, Seth, you mentioned submarines. I happened over Thanksgiving to watch a very interesting film. I don't know if you've seen it, called The Kursk, The Last Mission, which is about a Russian Oscar-class submarine that has a catastrophic accident. It was a quite telling portrayal of the difficulties that the Russians have had keeping up their military. And yet, what we are being told is that it is now exercising at levels that we haven't seen. I think this is true of all elements of their military, for that matter, the ground forces, the strategic missile forces, but also the Navy, including their submarine forces now operating at levels that we haven't seen since the Cold War in the Atlantic, for example. Is that correct? And does that tell us something about what they're up to? And should it be of concern?
Well, it should be of concern. As the Russians develop their, exercise more, return to a naval footing that is, if not the same as, at least an important shadow of their Cold War presence, That raises questions about ballistic missiles carrying submarines that are able to get into the North Atlantic and the threat that they pose, and their ability to track our submarines, which is not good, but it's certainly an objective of theirs. And that all, that's distilled in the problem that we're having with reaching the fleet-sized the goals that were set out by this administration.
We're going to drill down on that in a moment, but I did want to just ask you one further question about Russia and then turn to Iran as well. We'll do that right after this with Seth Cropsey, the author of Sea Blindness and Mayday, right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're visiting with Seth Cropsey for this full hour. Seth has a distinguished record of public service in the United States Navy, both on the uniform side and as a civilian senior official, the Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy. He has also been a very active contributor in his present role as the Senior Fellow and Director of the Hudson Institute Center for American Sea Power in really raising the alarm about what is happening to America's naval power, a very important subject of his book, Sea Blindness, How Political Neglect is Choking American Sea Power and What to Do About It. Seth, I want to talk about something that bears on Russia and China and exercises that they have recently been conducting, as I understand it, with the Islamic Republic of Iran, an ominous development on several different levels. I know you've been very focused on Iran and what's going on in the Persian Gulf, the threats that it poses to our friends and allies, our own naval forces, commercial vessels in the region, as well as targets ashore. What did you make of this seeming signal that the Russians and Chinese were going to be very much aligned with the Iranians in the event that push comes to shove with them?
Well, it's quite straightforward, I think, Frank, and that is the possibility of an axis between Iran, Russia, and China. It's not, it's not easy because Russia and China have some issues with one another, not the least of which is something that we've gone over before, and that is that while Russia seeks a greater presence regionally, China seeks world domination, and they might have some differences to resolve on that. But Iran is also a power that seeks regional hegemony, and it's situated next to the Persian Gulf. That's where it gets its name. And that's a matter of concern to us, not so much because we import a large percentage of our energy from there, we don't, but the rest of the world does, and the rest of the world's economy depends on exports of oil from the Persian Gulf, and if that is severely interrupted, as the Iranians demonstrated they were capable of doing, at least implying that they could, with their attack earlier this fall on the Saudi oil facilities. If that is in serious danger, the world economy is going to suffer as a result, and so will we, to say nothing of our allies who are more dependent upon oil from the Middle East, not only for their economies, but for their security. So the risk of a working axis between Tehran, Moscow, and Beijing is, I ought to be taken seriously.
Yes, indeed. Seth, let me ask you, as a serious strategic thinker, what was your attitude towards the decision that President Trump made, I guess now several times, in the wake of Iranian military or paramilitary action against commercial shipping, against our drone, and against, most dramatically, some assets of ours in places like Iraq, and of course, especially the major oil refinery complex in Saudi Arabia? Did you concur with the idea that, particularly against the backdrop of this Russian-Chinese axis with Iran, that he was well advised not to respond militarily, or not?
No, I don't agree with that. I think the administration has the right instincts about China and about Iran, but I think that it expects more from sanctions and from economic measures than it's going to get, especially on the security side. So I agree that economic sanctions are very effective, and if the administration points to the effect they've had on Iran, I would agree with that. But I think that the failure to respond, for example, to the attack on our drone also sends an important signal to the Iranians, and that is that, you know, on the military side, we'll sort of turn the eye the other way, turn a blind eye to that. But I don't think that's a good signal. I think it encourages them, and I think we can expect more attacks like we saw on the Saudi oil facilities. And we should be deterring them, not placing our faith only in sanctions.
Yeah, well, that's my view as well. Seth, in order to do that, though, you have to have the kind of capabilities that will enable you to deter not just the Iranians, but some of these other threats that we're talking about that are becoming more and more egregious. Let's talk about the U.S. Navy. Again, you've devoted much of your life to strengthening it and ensuring its effectiveness in operations. Could you give us just a snapshot at the moment, Seth, of how things stand with respect to everything from, you know, the readiness of the fleet? I saw that we had every single one of our Atlantic-based aircraft carriers in port, which I think is if not unprecedented situation, but it was very troubling when it was going on. We have problems with construction, I guess it is, of the Gerald Ford, the modernization program more generally. I mean, how are we doing? And when you look at the backdrop of what we've just been discussing in terms of the threats we have to contend with,
C plus, not yet a B minus. A lot of those issues will ultimately be resolved. Yes, the new Ford class has problems, but most new classes of ships have problems, and yes, it's cost too much money, and yes, it's been too much time, but I have confidence that in the end, the wrinkles will be ironed out. I'm more concerned about strategy, about the Navy's strategy. And generally speaking, the United States' strategy vis-a-vis China.
How would you characterize the current strategy first? Let's start with that.
No, and I wish I could. It's not clear to me at all. There was this idea several years ago called the air-sea battle. And that died on the semantics bureaucratic operating table about 5 years ago. The object was sensible, which was to counter China's increasingly robust.
This was during the Obama administration, as I recall.
Yes, yes. The object was sensible, which was to counter China's increasingly robust anti-access and area denial capabilities. But one of the questions that that concept, and it was never given the dignity of a strategy, left unanswered was, what do we do if we're able to penetrate the access denial and the area denial and defenses of China? And that question remains an operational issue. Questions that are and unanswered are, what are our objectives and how do we achieve them once we're able to penetrate, assuming that we can penetrate their area of denial? Is it to attack the Chinese shipping? Is it to close the archipelagic straits that lie between South China and the Middle East? This is not clear. And without a strategy, all the other questions of deterrence and war fighting hang in the balance.
Well, let me ask you, if I can, with respect to what you would recommend in terms of a strategy, what would it look like, Seth Cropsey? And you know, how would it differ from what my present miasma apparently is?
Well, I think the first question is, what is it that the Chinese value the most? And I think the answer to that is that what the Chinese leadership values the most is staying in exactly where they are, staying in power and turning back any challenges to it. And what does that depend on? That depends upon their ability to convincingly say to the Chinese population that their lives are improving, that they're becoming more prosperous. And that depends upon the being able to import raw materials and export finished goods. If they can't do that, then their economy is in serious trouble. And so the objective ought to be to put their economy into serious trouble by naval means, which is to say to sink their navy and make it impossible, difficult or impossible for them to receive raw materials and export finished products.
You know, this is presumably what they're expecting us to do. It makes sense. It makes sense. Seth, we're going to pause for just one last second. We're going to come back and we'll talk about, so what does it take to do that, to hold at risk what the Chinese may find deterring? That's the name of the game. And we'll talk about it with Seth Cropsey, the author of Sea Blindness and Mayday, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to this fourth and final installment of our conversation with Seth Cropsey, the former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy, former Assistant to Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger. Seth, you've laid out a sensible approach, it seems to me, to deterring the Chinese, namely by holding at risk the economic resources that they require to maintain power. What does it take in terms of our own naval capabilities in light of what the Chinese are building to defend, you know, the sea lines of communication, as they're called, that enable that resupply of the Chinese economy, that maintain the Communist Party in power? Would it be more of the same, more aircraft carriers in particular? Would it be simply more platforms of different kinds? Would it involve unmanned vessels and vehicles in the air as well? I mean, how do you see the Navy having to adapt to these new circumstances? And is there any prospect that it's going to?
The last question is the most difficult one, but the ones that preceded it, I can take a shot at. We need much greater emphasis on a larger number of smaller and more affordable ships, as opposed to continuing to build basically the same kinds of ships that that were useful during the Cold War, large destroyers and cruisers, and even frigates that can do all the naval missions, anti-submarine warfare, anti-surface warfare, anti-air warfare. And in answer to your question about drones, that is a large part of the answer, which is to put those capabilities aboard drones that are highly lethal and large in number, and I expect less expensive than the cost of a destroyer today. It's also, and this is a place where I think that the Navy is going in the right direction, requires more submarine capability. The recent contract that was signed with Electric Boat for $22 billion to build nine Virginia-class attack submarines with expanded capability for missiles is a step in the right direction, largest contract ever awarded by the Navy. So I would not say building more aircraft carriers is the answer. I think that a submarine fleet that also includes a large number of drones, unmanned underwater vehicles, a greatly increased mining capability, a greatly increased lethality of surface drones that are able to protect themselves as well as carry the fight to the enemy is essential. One more thing, and an amphibious capability that can be relied on to close off as necessary the straits that connect the Middle East with the South China Sea, and all the islands in the Western Pacific, whose names are familiar to anybody who knows anything about World War II. If you do all of those things, then start to put the Chinese Navy at risk.
Let me ask you about those islands in the South Pacific and elsewhere, the Western Pacific, South China Sea, that were fought over and recovered at huge cost to American servicemen and women. Seth Cropsey, the prospect that the Chinese have stolen a march with these islands, both in terms of, in some cases, simply manufacturing them and arming them in the South China Sea, notably, or flipping them from sort of pro-Taiwan and pro-Western governments, or at least governmental policies, to being much more aligned with China. This is not, strictly speaking, a naval question, of course, but the presence of the United States Navy and the credibility of its power projection, I have the feeling, is a backdrop for many of these, well, you might call them separate peace decisions that the folks in these very strategic parts of the world are now making. How do you see that? Is that something that, you know, flows from the sorts of decisions that we've been making about naval power that you have decried?
I think those, first of all, the islands in the South China Sea are less of an operational issue than the larger islands beyond the first island chain, because the islands in the South China Sea are quite small, so they can be made to go away with a few missile attacks. The islands in the beyond the first island chain are not quite small.
And that's a term the Chinese, of course, use to describe what they consider basically to be their internal waters, right, inside that line. You're talking, just put names on them, you're talking about the Philippines, you're talking about Indonesia? I mean, what are you thinking of specifically?
Well, no, I'm Japan. I mean, Japan lies at the northern end of the first island chain, right? So they mean not just the South China Sea, but the East China Sea, the waters north of that, and extending south to Vietnam. But the islands that they put in the South China Sea, they built and then armed, I'm just saying, are less of an operational problem than the islands that, the natural islands that exist further out in the Pacific. Because those have the ability to, I mean, if taken, those have the ability to project power from and to use as bases for the Chinese Navy.
We've seen it done before, that's for sure, with the Japanese in World War II. Yeah. Okay, so Seth, just to wrap this all up, you have laid out, I think, very handsomely the challenges that we're facing in waters all over the world, increasingly from China, even waters quite distant from the mainland, to some extent from the Russians, even the Iranians, perhaps most especially what they might do in concert with one another. You've described real challenges that we're facing, too, strategic in character as well as in terms of the number of vessels. Would you just close out by describing, if you were king or president or had the president's ear, what would you specifically be recommending at this moment be done to deal with the sea blindness, the May Day conditions we find ourselves in? Can you do it in 2 minutes?
Try. I already said something about the fleet architecture. That would require an increase in the size of the fleet. We would have to pay for that. We would also need to include, which we're not doing right now, substantial surface and undersea drones as part of the fleet, which I think at the point that their capability merits it, deserve to be included in that. But that all of that requires some money.
And shipbuilding capacity, too, right?
And shipbuilding capacity, right.
Is it inadequate at the moment, our shipbuilding capacity, particularly relative to what the Chinese are up to?
It's adequate to our plans, and our plans depend upon the monies that we're willing to spend on it, and those monies are going to decrease in the Trump administration. The increases in defense are set to decrease over the next two or three years. And they're not major decreases, but it's hard to build up a fleet while the overall, while the bottom line is going down. I don't think that the only alternative is to increase the defense bill. There are other ways to manage this, but they're not being considered. Specifically, a strategic allocation of resources between the military services. If there is a conflict with China, it's not going to be on the Asian mainland. It's not going to involve the army. We should be looking at changes in the way the defense budget is distributed so that the army receives less and the navy receives more.
This is a topic that we're going to turn to on another occasion for sure, Seth Cropsey. We thank you so much for joining us today and for the great work that you do at the Hudson Institute. I hope you will be a frequent visitor with us in 2020, and we appreciate all of your inputs to us over the past year. Best for the season to you, and come back to us again next year, if you will. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.